Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hi, PD Stories listeners. We just wanted to take a moment to let you all know we wish you are staying safe and healthy during this challenging time. Thank you to everyone for doing their part to stay inside for our collective well-being, and a very big thank you to all the first responders out there keeping us safe. In today's episode, we'll be discussing sensitive subject matter, including accounts of suicide. Please listen at your own discretion. Today I'm speaking with police officer Miguel Van Brackel, who has served in the New York City Police Department for 7 years and has spent his entire career on patrol within the confines of the 67th Precinct in East Flatbush, Brooklyn.
He decided to come back with a Molotov cocktail, throw it into the lobby, and then roll the gate down, and almost 200 people died.
Before serving as a police officer, Officer Van Brackel was a former EMT for the New York City Fire Department.
He had gotten stabbed in the chest. He had a sucking chest wound to the top of his left side of his chest, and, you know, he's walking around talking.
Already had the pleasure of speaking with you for the Protect, Serve, and Understand workshop. But we'd like to get more in-depth about your career and your experiences.
At the time, you're just sort of pushing through it all, but I'll never forget the look on that young woman's face.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Don. Thanks for having me.
Now, I hear that you started off in an office job and then decided that just wasn't going to be for you.
Yeah, actually, you know, I started out my career, you know, I went to school, got an office job. I was working in marketing. You know, I was a paper pusher, and I did that for quite a while. Just wasn't fulfilling enough. 2008 came along. We had the financial crisis. I don't know if you remember back then, but I decided, hey, I'm getting older. Now's my chance to try to, you know, fulfill a lifelong dream. So I took the test to become a New York City police officer. It's quite a long process from when you mm-hmm. actually take the test to get appointed. So mm-hmm. in the meantime, I got an EMT certification and wound up getting hired by the fire department of New York City.
And what was it like being an EMT when you first went out on the street?
It was really interesting. I went to Station 39 within the confines of the 75, which is East New York.
Mm-hmm. East New York, Brooklyn.
East New York, Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. It's a very busy pay. Very busy place. It was my first exposure. Yeah, I grew up in Brooklyn, but I lived in another part of Brooklyn. So it was my first exposure to that part of that area in Brooklyn, and it's you know, very very busy. A lot of trauma calls, a lot of crime related medical situations, a lot of motor vehicle accidents, things like that.
I ask you a question. What's it like trying to drive a patrol car through New York City? I mean, I watch EMTs. You've done it in an ambulance.
Yes.
You've done it in a police car. And the traffic here in New York is just unbelievable. And I watch ambulances trying to get through intersections in Manhattan. And it's just crazy.
It is. It is tough. It's like NASCAR, you know. It's so difficult. You know, you're trying to, like, maneuver around cars and swerve and you know, no one wants to move out of your way, right? And some people don't know what to do, so they just freeze. And
then other ones are giving you hand signs.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, and so it becomes a real challenge. I mean, you know, as a cop, I sort of get it. You know, people don't really like cops, right? So why not? But for an ambulance, like, an ambulance can't get through. Like, that could be your mom dying. Like, you
right,
know,
right?
I mean, you would think that would come, you know. Mm-hmm. Go through someone's mind, but
I've seen firsthand that it doesn't seem to matter to a lot of people.
It really doesn't.
Yeah.
The only department they seem to get out of the way of is FD. Everyone gets out of the way of FD, of the fire trucks.
Yeah.
I think it's just because of the size. They're so intimidated by those trucks.
Speaking of FDI, I asked somebody one day, I said, I wonder how many times the F-bomb is dropped in the city of New York in the course of one 24-hour period. Because it's got to be exponential, uncountable. Basically.
Uncountable, absolutely.
Yeah,
uncountable.
And traffic is just like, I've been in cabs and cars and people are just cursing the people and cab drivers. I'm in a cab and one cab driver's cursing another one out and threatening to get out and fight. And I'm just sitting there in the back seat like, dude, I mean, do we really have to go this far with all this just because he didn't let you in?
Yeah, it becomes very personal. Yeah. People take it very personally. You
know? They do. New Yorkers take some things really personally, yeah. And traffic is one of them.
Yeah, that and someone parking in your driveway. I think those are the big things that tick off New Yorkers. At least that's what happens in our command. You know, people will park in other people's driveway and it becomes a huge deal. You know,
and just put their car in else's driveway.
Absolutely, just
at their house.
At their house, yeah. Like not care. I think it's a Brooklyn thing, to be honest. You know, but
I know they don't do that in Maryland where I live. That's for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, we get a lot of calls for that.
Now, you had a lot of influence from your family growing up on the Lower East Side. Your grandmother, they always told you the police were the good guys and to look up to the police. Did that influence you?
Yes. So, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up on the Lower East Side. We lived in the projects right near One Police Plaza. There's a housing project right there.
Mm-hmm.
it was a different place back then in New York City, right? Early 80s. One of my earliest memories was my mom walking me. We lived on Houston Street. My mom walking me, down Houston Street towards Christie Park, and you know, her pulling me away, saying, you know, be careful because there was hypodermic needles everywhere. You know, now it's a completely different place down there. It's just nowhere near what it was back then. But growing up, my grandmother would take me around Delancey Street, and again, completely different environment than it is today. And, there would be cops on the beat, standing on their post or walking around. And she'd always point them out and be like, you know, those are the good guys. Those are the guys that are going to help you if you're in trouble. So if you're in trouble and I'm not here, you make sure you find a cop. And that always stuck in my head, you know.
How old were you when you became a police officer?
I was a bit older, you know. I got hired when I was 35 years old. So, typically guys get hired in their early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the old man on the job when I took it.
Now, being an EMT prior to that, you must have seen a lot of horrific things.
I saw quite a few things. Yeah, you know. Fortunately, I worked day tour when I was assigned to the Station 39 in Flatbush. In East New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the jobs we had early on were, you know, taking grandma to the hospital, you know, because she wasn't feeling well. So there was a lot of those medical related calls. But when I'd cover overtime, it would typically be an overtime shift at night. And so I had a chance to, you know, deal with a couple of intense situations. One guy, we had gotten a call of a stabbing. And so we head over there and PD had already had him out. I already brought him down. And this guy was walking around. He had gotten stabbed in the chest. He had a sucking chest wound to the top of his left side of his chest. And, he's walking around talking, you know, and we get him into the ambulance. We put an occlusive dressing on. We're taking his vitals. We're getting him oxygen. He's like, man, this really hurts. You guys got painkiller? And I'm like, no, we're BLS. Like, we can't give you painkiller. He's like, I've been shot 3 times. It didn't hurt this bad. This really hurts.
He was living wrong, apparently.
Yeah. So, we took him over to the hospital. He was absolutely fine. Luckily, it was only a shallow intrusion into his chest wall. So he had some diminished breathing, but he made it. He did all right. Tough guy.
Any calls for service involving children that you recall?
Yeah. So there was a call that I recall particularly. It involved a kid who was jumping around his bedroom. He fell off the bed and he wound up fracturing his femur, which is like the largest bone in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And, incredibly painful break. And, you know, we get there and this kid's, you know, leg is obviously deformed from the fracture, and had to put on a pediatric traction splint. And when I was going through the academy, I remember them telling me, you'll probably never do this in your career, but this is how you do it. And here I am, you know, a couple months out doing exactly what some people have never done in their career just because of nature of the injury, you know.
What about mentally unstable patients?
Yeah, those were quite often, there's a lot of folks that, have different different issues. We would deal with people that were either off their medication or had, you know, ingested some kind of illegal drugs, affecting their, you know, ability to process information. And, you know, those are really challenging calls because you're just responding with a stethoscope and an O2 bag, you know, and you don't know what's going to happen with this individual, you know. You'd always call for police and have them arrive first, but there are many
times. A lot of times you get there before the police.
Sure, yeah. A lot of times, or you're sitting there waiting for them to come, and the person that you're supposed to be helping is walking up to your ambulance saying, hey, you know, I have all this stuff going on. So you're dealing with them, you know, and you got to use your judgment as to what you can handle and what you can't.
Did you ever get into a physical altercation with a patient?
We had patients that tried to, you know, assault us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, they had to be restrained. You know, usually police was there, but if they weren't, if we were en route, you had to, you know, do what you had to do. You had to restrain them, you know, when absolutely necessary.
Now, you started off in the 67th Precinct, right?
Yes.
And that's one of the busiest commands in the whole city.
It is one of them, yes.
What's it like out there, especially when you first went to the streets as a rookie?
So I was one of the last classes that went into started their police career through Operation Impact. And basically, as a rookie, you would come out and you'd be sent to a command, and you're on a foot post. Our command on the east side of our command, it borders Brownsville, Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. It's our sector, Charlie. So we, you know, myself and the cops that I came out with, we would be assigned to a post. And, you know, your post was, you know, 3 or 4 blocks in length, and you had to walk the beat. And when I first started, you were by yourself. You know, you had an adjacent post that you could walk with.
As a rookie?
As a rookie, yeah.
They put you out there by yourself?
You were by yourself. You're it, mm-hmm. you know? If you ran into something that you didn't know, you contacted one of your mentors, which was a more senior officer that would help you kind of figure out what was going on. But, you know, you got your training in the academy, you're good to go. Go out and, you know, do some police work. And early on, that's what we did.
Have there been some big gang shootouts in your precinct since you've been on?
There have. There's a lot of gunfire that happens. It's diminished significantly over the last few years. You know, the leadership in our command has really done an amazing job at deploying the resources in places where they need to be, and shootings have come down tremendously. But there's, you know, still way more gunfire than there should be, obviously. There have been situations where, you know, multiple people have been shot. And when I first came out, it was more prevalent.
You know, there was a weekend last fall in New York City where no one was shot and killed in all 5 boroughs. And it was all over the news that literally no one was shot and killed in a city of 8 million people that one weekend. Do you remember that?
I do. And it's an amazing story. If you think about, you know, I grew up in the early 90s, and, you know, there were shootings every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were getting killed every day.
Mm-hmm.
So the city has changed dramatically since then, you know, just within my lifetime. And, you know, I'm old enough to know how it was and to see the city back then and to see, you know, the progression since, and it's pretty amazing to hear. It's a pretty amazing story to hear.
Now, within your first 2 years on the job, I understand you were awarded a medal for an action you took.
Yes. So I received a commendation for a job that we had. It was a gunpoint robbery, and I was driving my sergeant at the time, and we were Sergeant Vulcan. We were driving towards a job. We see an RMP pull up just ahead of us, and there's someone talking to the RMP. Radio, mobile patrol. They take off. The two cops take off, and we go up to the person. It was the complainant, the person who stated he had gotten robbed. He tells us that two males had just, you know, robbed him at gunpoint, pointed a gun to his head. One male's wearing a blue jacket. Looks like it has a hat on it. So, you know, we proceed to, you know, go ahead and canvass for this individual. So we're driving around, and a block or two away, we come across another post that's on foot, and, you know, we pull up to them, and they flag us down. They're like, oh, we just saw two guys that we, you know, look like the two that you're talking about. They just turned the corner. So we speed off, and as we approach that corner, there are two individuals, you know, walking down the block, and sure enough, one of them's wearing a blue jacket with a hat on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I throw the car in park, and I just run towards those individuals, and they they turn around, they hear my footsteps, they see me, and they take off, right? So now it's a foot chase. My sergeant's behind me somewhere, and I'm running after these two guys. One guy makes a quick left into a building, and this complex of buildings is all interconnected. And I knew if he went into that building, there was no way I was going to get him. Mm. Little did I know that at that time, he actually got stuck between the vestibule door and the door to the entry of the building. So he was stuck there. But I focused on the other guy that I thought I could catch because I just assumed he was gone in the wind inside that building. So I followed that individual. He made a sharp left around the building, and I came around. And that's when I saw him pull a gun out of his waistband, never pointing it at me, but tossed it through a gate. And so, you know, I drew my gun, put him down on the ground at gunpoint, got on top of him. My sergeant came along. We cuffed him up. And then, you know, we recovered a loaded 45 firearm that was defaced. He was a gang member. His friend was a big gang member. And yeah, so we got a medal for that one.
Now, in your 7 years on the job, you've had over 100 arrests, but you've also been injured in the line of duty several times.
I have, yes.
Tell me about the first injury you got.
The first injury wasn't so. We were on a domestic job, and a guy had just assaulted his wife. He jumped out of a window to, you know, flee the scene as we pulled up. And there was no easy access to the area that he jumped out through. So I thought, okay, well, let me go out after him. It was a, you know, story and a half up off the ground. It wasn't that far. And I said, okay, well, maybe if I hop out, I can go see maybe he's hiding back there somewhere. So I go to hop out the building, and my leg got stuck. And when it got stuck, it kind of twisted, and I landed bad, and I wound up tearing a meniscus in my left knee.
How long were you out for that?
Only like 6 to 8 weeks. That wasn't too bad.
You know, a lot of people don't understand that it's almost like being in the NFL. When you're a police officer, injuries are a part of the job. It comes along with it. And
it does.
A lot of them are torn this and torn that.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, more recently I had an injury where I tackled a fleeing suspect and I dislocated my shoulder, tore my labrum. That required extensive surgery to repair it. I'm still recuperating now, still going to physical therapy. And that's been, you know, over 8 months. So.
Now, the unit you work with right now, you concentrate on illegal parties in that section of Brooklyn.
Yes.
Tell me about that squad and what that entails.
Back in the early, late 80s, early 90s, there was a social club in the Bronx called the Happyland Social Club. And it was a storefront, you know, that had, you know, a bar set up. They weren't licensed. They didn't really have any safety features that you would normally assume with an actual, you know, bar, no lights, no fire extinguishers, things of that nature. And when they were operating, you know, they would always be over capacity. There was always way more people
just
in
packed.
There, just packed out, right? So back then, there was a patron that got upset. He got kicked out of the bar. He decided to come back with a Molotov cocktail, throw it into the lobby, and then roll the gate down, and almost 200 people died.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was complete tragedy, and it resulted in a lot of changes to the alcohol beverage control laws in New York State. What we do in the 6-7 is we enforce a lot of those laws because there are a lot of similar situations that happen within the command where you have illegal parties that aren't safe, that have known gang members that associate there.
And people charge to get in too, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, they're selling entry or they're selling drinks directly at a bar, and you'll walk into someone's residence and it's a legit bar setup. You know, they have a bar, they have a DJ, they have lights,
maybe even strippers.
Yeah, I've actually had that happen. And you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, everyone wants to have a good time, but the end result could be really tragic, right? It takes one person just letting off a couple rounds and you have a stampede and people get hurt, or there's a fire and, you know, people get hurt. So we go in and we shut a lot of these illegal parties down. We go into the licensed premises and make sure that their setups are up to code, that they're also doing the right thing, that their safety equipment's in order and things like that. And we do that in conjunction with other city agencies.
And that can be a very hostile situation. How many cops are going to come into a party? Let's say there's a party going on in some illegal venue. There's maybe 200 people there. And you come in with what? How many people?
It's usually one sergeant and eight cops.
One sergeant, eight cops.
That's usually how we operate.
Have you gotten into any large scrums, melees?
It's happened. Yes, it's happened. You know, you go to shut down a party, and obviously everyone's intoxicated, right? And as the night progresses, people get more and more intoxicated. So we had a situation where we walked in to this illegal party, just like we talked about. Walk in, there's some exotic dancers doing their thing. There's a whole DJ set up. The party's pumping, right? The party's pumping. So we go in to shut it down, and people aren't happy, right? So they start exiting, and part of that is, you know, talking smack to the cops as they leave. And, you know, that comes par for the course. But once it gets physical, obviously, then things change, right? So,
and you're outnumbered.
Oh.
Vastly
outnumbered, right? Mm-hmm. Vastly outnumbered. You know, we're asking people to leave. People are filtering out. At the same time, we're also clearing corners. We don't know who's doing what where.
Who's got a gun?
It's a low-light situation. You know, there's a lot of these basements are set up with multiple rooms and sub-rooms. And so, you know, we're split up. Some of us are at the door trying to get people out. Some of us are effecting arrests because now you got to arrest the bartender, you got to get the DJ, whoever's throwing the parties in charge, so they have to get
you arrest the DJ too?
Usually they get released on summonses.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I hate to see DJs go to jail.
I mean, technically they could, but it's not something we normally do. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you're actually part of the business side of the venue, then we have to at least check you out, right? Make sure you're not wanted for anything. So they wind up, you know, we wind up clearing some rooms. You know, as mm-hmm. people are leaving, somebody decides to push a cop. Fight breaks out on the front. We head over there, myself, my partner's helping other people out with whatever things that they're doing. But I see two cops struggling with a rather large individual. So I run over there. We grab this guy, and we're wrestling with him. And he turns around and swings at one of the cops. And now it turns into a full-on fight, right? We're fighting with this guy. And we get him to the ground. We get one cuff on him, and he decides he's a pretty big guy. I'm 6'3", 240. This guy is strong. He just pushes us off like we're two kids, just like bounces us off. We keep wrestling with this guy. As that's happening, another cop somewhere else winds up getting hit with a folding chair, like WWE, like full on hit with a folding chair. So we hear screaming. The cop that's helping me out goes to help them out. And now it's just me and this guy. And
so it's now you fighting this guy.
Me fighting this guy. And there's another cop that's there that's trying to help me out, but they're also trying to run over to help the other groups out. And I wind up, you know, putting this guy in a hold and dragging him to the ground. And so I'm holding him on top of me, and I'm just holding him there because I knew if I let him go, he's going to turn around and strike one of the officers that's with me. You know, there's a smaller female.
You're holding him on top of you.
Yes. So he's on top of me, and I've got him locked. So that he can't get off me. The reasoning is I knew that eventually somebody would come over and help me out. So, I, you know, as I'm holding him,
But it seems like an eternity, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you're fighting with someone, that takes, you know, it may only be a minute. It seems like it's an hour, you know.
Did you try to reach for your gun?
No. At that point, my main concern was holding him in place so that I could get someone else to come and help, right? So I do that. I tell one of the other cops, go get... another officer, Officer Carpio. I'm like, go get Officer Carpio, have him come over here. And at that point, I see my partner, you know, walking by. He had a couple of people in handcuffs off to the side, and I see him walking over, and I call out to him. I'm like, Nemeth, tase him. So he comes over, he tases the guy, and then finally we're able to get the handcuffs on him. But, you know, during that time, it seemed like it was forever. It seemed like it was absolutely forever.
What's the scariest situation you've encountered on the streets of the 67? The one that really, really where you thought, if this goes the way it could go, this could be a life-changing or life-ending event.
The one that I mentioned has to be probably one of the worst situations that I've gotten into.
That party fight,
yeah. Just because we were so outnumbered, you know, And things were going bad everywhere.
Tell our audience about the 6-7, that part of Brooklyn, what it's like. Just forget about crime and punishment, but just kind of paint the picture for what is your beat like? What kind of people are there? What kind of businesses? What kind of culture? What kind of community?
Sure. So the 6-7 is predominantly West Indian. So you have a lot of people from the islands, vibrant culture, great food, a lot of nightlife. There's constant parties, and we were responding to you know, noise complaints and parties almost all week long.
7 days a week?
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
People
yeah.
just partying 7 days
partying
a week.
Out. It'll be Thursday. It'll be like a Tuesday night, and you know, calls come over for a noise complaint. You know, because there's a crazy party going on, especially in the summer. You know, it gets a little quieter in the winter, but summertime it's party time. You know, and it borders Brownsville, so you know some of those incidents that you saw with the officers being hit with the water and stuff like that. That's our eastern end. That's near that happened in the 7-3 where we border them on our east. And that's, you know, that area that we bordered the 7-3 with, that's where, you know, my foot post was when I was just out as a rookie.
In your 7 years, how has the beat changed in terms of level of crime, volume of crime, types of crimes?
Yeah, so when I first got to the 6-7, you know, again, I was assigned to a foot post. You know, that's changed dramatically. Now, when cops come out the academy, they're brought in with, you know, they're brought out and they're actually shown where they're going to patrol first. They actually come out in their grays and they see the command and they get shown areas that, you know, that they're going to be interacting with and the people they're going to be interacting with. On top of that, when they do come out, they're assigned to a training officer. So they actually, you know, a very senior cop that shows them the ropes on how to do their job on a day-to-day basis, right? And that happens for 6 months after they come out the academy. So, it's, you know, the department's made a lot of strides to increase the amount of training that they get before they, you know, actually hit the street. So that's fantastic. Crime has come down quite a bit. We're still a busy place. I don't think the 6-7 will ever stop being the 6-7, but it's come down, you know, a tremendous amount. And, you know, due to the efforts of all the folks, you know, I think we have the best cops in the city. You know, other commands will argue that point, but, you know, people work hard and they're very talented and dedicated individuals that work very diligently in order to make crime go down in that command.
What does it mean to you personally to be a part of such a renowned and legendary police force as the NYPD?
To me, it's a sense of pride that I'm able to, you know, continue the traditions that the NYPD has generated throughout the years. When I put on my uniform and I go out into my command, I feel that, you know, I'm actually going to make a difference. And I feel that, you know, as an NYPD officer, there are things and there are situations that I'll experience that other cops just won't.
For example?
A good example is within our command. So our command's very busy. If you took a cop from the 6-7, 7-5, 7-3, cops that work in these busy places, and you put them in any situation in the city, they would handle it without an issue, where that doesn't really happen in other commands, I think. You know, if you're in a slower place and people come to the 6-7, it's a bit of a culture shock, right? And, you know, it's an environment where, you know, you get to interact with people and be around situations that you would never even imagine.
Like what?
So a good example, I was on routine patrol one day, me and my partner. There's a corner. So, you know, within the sector that we were in, there's a Lenox Road, which is like a 2-lane road. And then there's Utica, which is like a 4-lane road. So like a pretty busy intersection, right? And there was a bodega at a corner, and across from it was like a post office. So the bodega at the corner, we knew that there was a guy that would always be out there drinking. When we were, you know, as rookies, we'd go and we'd, you know, chase him away. But we knew he'd always be out there drinking. And, you know, we'd drive by and just, you know, take a look. He'd wave or he'd be out there. And one day we drive by the corner and he's on the floor face down. We're like, oh, man, there's so-and-so. He's on the ground. Probably had too much, so let's just head over there and make sure he's okay. So we go over, and you know, we're checking on him. Okay, yeah, he's really drunk, so we call an ambulance. Let's get him some help, because this is not good. Like, it's more than just his normal, you know, routine. He's really had way too much today. Call for an ambulance. As we're sitting there with him, as he's sitting there and we're standing there with him and waiting for the ambulance, we hear an engine just rev like a demon, like just completely floored it. We can hear it. And
is it close? Is it nearby?
It's close enough that we hear it. You know, it's basically across the street. You know, we turn and we look in the direction that we hear the noise from, and we see this, you know, late model Audi flying down the sidewalk. Absolutely
down the sidewalk.
Down the sidewalk. He's going against traffic. He jumps the sidewalk, flies down the sidewalk. He barrels into a telephone pole. And the impact on the telephone pole was so violent, it actually snapped the telephone pole in half, and the car went airborne. It was.
Are you just watching this?
We're just watching this. And we're like, what is going on? And we actually, you know, it's like something out of like Fast and the Furious. The car is like flipping in the air. It hits a light post and then just slides down the light post. And, you know, here we are just thinking we're going to take care of this guy that just had too much to drink. And now we're in the middle of this crazy situation. You know, we're thinking, God knows what happened, you know, to the people in this car now.
And you're an EMT also. Yeah. You're trained, so you know how to respond immediately.
Right. And so, you know, I'm thinking, man, you know, these guys are seriously hurt. So we leave the guy who's passed out. He's okay. And we run over to you know, this car that is completely destroyed. Completely. All the airbags are deployed. The car looks like Godzilla stepped on it, basically. Mm. And as we're running over there, the driver gets out of the car and starts running away. So we're like, what's going on? And he's running away. And we stop. We're like, hey, stop. We get him. We sit him down. And he's absolutely, absolutely drunk, like completely DWI, completely drunk.
And this is in the daytime?
This was early evening, maybe 9 o'clock at night. Okay. Yeah, 9 o'clock at night. So not, you know, it wasn't, thankfully it wasn't earlier because there would have been so many more people on the street. Mm-hmm. But it was late enough that, you know, foot traffic died down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But we were in the middle of this crazy scene. He winds up, you know, being DWI. So, you know, arrest him for DWI. Get him in an ambulance. The only thing he had wrong with him was a broken foot. This is the driver, I mean.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really was.
What about, was he the only one in the car?
Only one in the car. The car, again, the car wound up being stolen on top of it. You know, he took it for a joyride.
Oh, imagine that.
Yeah. And beautiful late model Audi completely destroyed. When he hit the light post, we thought the entire... You know, the light post in that area. I'm sorry, not the light post.
Electricity?
The electricity in that area is all connected. It runs above ground, so there's there's wire. So when he hit that light pole, we thought the entire thing was going to come down on top of us because everything shook. Everything shook. The entire length of wire shook, which included the wires that were directly above us when we're standing there with the guy who was intoxicated. Mm. That's definitely one of the more crazy situations.
Been involved in any situations that involved gunplay or you having to actually draw your gun, weapon, and fire shots?
I've never had to fire a shot, thank God, and hopefully I never do. I've had to draw my weapon a few times on different jobs. It's just the nature of where we work. It gets pretty busy. There are very dangerous situations that we come across, violent crimes that are happening, you know, in the moment. You know, everything from, you know, imitation firearms to real firearms. But thankfully, you know, knock on wood, never had to fire my weapon.
What's the most emotionally touching call for service you've responded to or incident you've been present and had to work?
This was pretty tough. It was a 19-year-old suicide victim, still in college. We responded to the call of someone hanging. And we get to the location. We go upstairs. Two cops arrived just before us. They had cut the ligature and pulled her down. But she was 19 years old, and she took her life for reasons that I don't know. The squad investigated that, and you know, we never really see what happens afterwards. But to see someone that young, you know, in school, and from what the family had said was, you know, top student and doing very well. That was extremely difficult. I'm a father. My daughter is getting close to that age. And that was probably the most difficult thing I had to see. And then speaking to the mother and speaking to the family afterwards. That was...
At the scene or...
At the scene, yeah. They came to the scene. And, you know, it's something that you'll never forget. You'll never forget. And then, you know, having to speak with the sister and the mother... Explain what we found, and it's something that if I never have to do it again, I would be very glad.
Yeah, even now I can see the emotion in your face as you recount it.
Yeah, it was very tough. It was tough. It was tough to see. It was tough to do. At the time, you're just sort of pushing through it all. But you know, I'll never forget. I'll never forget the look on that young woman's face. And there's a you know, a bunch of other situations that we had. This was a call that I responded to. back when I was on foot. So I'm on foot by myself, just at my corner. At the time, it was the hot corner for the command, 95 and Clarkson, right down the block from the house of Bobby Shmurda. And I'm standing there on post, and
Bobby Shmurda, the rapper?
The rapper, yeah.
Yeah.
His little group of guys, they hung out on that block.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on my post. This is the post, so you had to make sure you were on your post and you were doing what you had to do. And a kid comes over. He's like, "Hey, my uncle just broke my aunt's car mirror." And I'm like, "Okay, where's your aunt?" He's like, "Oh, she's coming." I'm like, "Okay, where's your uncle?" "He just walked into that bodega across the street." And I'm like, "And so now I'm asking, you know, this young man, okay, what happened?" And he tells me what happened. The aunt comes over. She's like, "Yeah, you know, he got angry. He broke my side view mirror." So I'm like, "Okay, well, I'm it. So I'm gonna head over there, you know, and talk to this guy." So I go across the street, go to talk to the individual. I bring them with me. I'm like, "Is that him?" And they're like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Okay, cool." So I, you know, pull my handcuffs. I'm like, "Sir, put your hands behind your back." He takes off like a bat out of hell, right out the store. So now it's a foot chase, right? So now I'm chasing him down the block. Now I'm running, and he makes a quick turn. Like, we're halfway down the block. He makes a quick right between two parked cars. As he gets into the middle of the street, he gets destroyed by an SUV. Destroyed,
what?
Yes. Like, this guy's like 10 feet in the air and lands face down on the ground. And now I have maybe 6 or 7 months out of the academy, and I'm like, I'm going to get fired. Because here
why?
I am.
Why are you
going
to get fired?
Well, at the time was when everything was going on with, you know, the stop, question, and frisk and everything. And mm-hmm. there's so much scrutiny. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I just chased this kid into traffic, and he just got killed by this SUV. So he lands face down on the ground. And, you know, I go over the radio, ask for additional units. They run over because we're all on foot now. So mm-hmm. they run over. The guy who hit him takes off. All right. So I'm
now it's a hit and run.
Now it's hit and run. And now the people that are on the street see what happened. They come out and surround me. And they're like, "You killed him." And they're yelling and screaming. And so now, you know, the other cops rush over. They push the crowd back. I start assessing this guy now, right? Because now I'm thinking, okay, he's got severe trauma. Like, you know, mm-hmm. we need an ambulance here quick.
Mm-hmm.
Start assessing the guy, and you know he's saying he has neck pain, back pain. He's not able to move at all. Ambulance gets there. You know they board him up. The driver returns. The driver wind up having like a suspended license.
Mm-hmm. But he came back to the scene.
He did come back to the scene. Had a suspended license, so he wound up having to arrest him for the suspended license.
Okay, so the guy you were chasing for breaking the mirror gets hit by the SUV.
Yeah,
he's in the street. EMTs come. They take him away, but he still has a charge for breaking the mirror.
Yes, still has a charge for breaking the mirror. So, you know, we're still on probation, right? So like, everything has to be done by the book, right?
Right.
So, yeah, you're going to arrest that guy for breaking the mirror. You're going to arrest that guy for, you know, for
driving with no license,
and hitting him, right?
But really, the accident wasn't the fault of the driver, because the guy jumped out into the street in front of him, right?
That's right, right. So the driver's big crime, I guess, is just driving without a license, but because of the nature of the situation, he winds up going to. And that was pretty crazy. And like that was my first real situation that I had been as a police officer where I had no idea what to do. I was like, what do I do now? Like, I'm going to get this guy an ambulance, but.
And people are gathering around,
yeah,
and they're mad at you.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they believe it's your fault that he got hit by the SUV.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the environment that we were working in at the time. Yeah, so that's that story. And
that's a crazy story.
Yeah.
Miguel, there have been quite a few NYPD officers committing suicide in the past year. It's been, some are calling it an epidemic. What do you think is behind it? Obviously, police officers traditionally have had higher suicide rates than many other professions in our society, but this has been an unusual spate here in New York City lately. And what is available to NYPD officers for mental health?
Well, there has been an increase, seeming increase in the number of people that have committed suicide, police officers that have committed suicide. Like you said, historically, you know, access to a firearm,
mm-hmm.
it makes it a lot easier to make a split-second decision that will end your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in terms of the mental health outreach programs that the department has, there are many programs that officers can use to get help if they need it. they're there. There's a lot of different programs, and more becoming available, you know, especially in light of everything that's happened. It's a difficult job. I mean, and I think it's only gotten more difficult over the last few years, you know, even with a lot of the strides that have been, you know, taken to, you know, increase accountability, you know, body cams and things like that. A lot of times I think officers feel that, you know, the public really don't trust their decisions when they happen. And it could be disparaging. It could be challenging. And it's something that I think everyone grapples with at some point in their career, you know, like, why am I doing this? They don't even want us here sometimes, it seems, you know? And, you know, that's something that makes it more difficult to be a police officer. I feel like, you know, in light of some of the, you know, the things that have come out with some of the incidents, you know, Officer Panaleo, Sergeant Barry, cops see this, right? They say, okay, well, I'm going out there and I'm fighting the good fight. And if I make a mistake, it could be life-changing, right? And so there's a lot more scrutiny, I think, now, and a lot more, just a lot more gravity to the situation overall. And I think that does impact people to a certain extent.
Have you known any officer personally that committed suicide?
I don't.
Or from your precinct or from your command?
There was a former detective. I didn't know him, but he was assigned to the 6-7 at one point, and he did commit suicide this year. Yes, and you know, it's a terrible thing to hear. It's an absolute terrible thing to hear. You know, obviously for the officer that committed suicide and for his family, and my heart goes out to them. You know, and to hear that someone has taken that step is really emotionally troubling.
Now, there was a phenomenon going on this past summer here in New York, and people were walking up to police officers and hitting them with water balloons or throwing buckets of water on them for reasons I didn't quite understand. And maybe you can help me and our audience understand what that was all about.
So there were a couple of highly publicized events that happened. One was in a neighboring command, the 7-3, and then I believe one was in Harlem or the Bronx, where officers were being doused with water, you know.
Just randomly by...
Well, randomly in result of their taking police action for whatever reason. They were responding to radio runs mm-hmm. or effecting arrests, and during that process, you know, large groups of young men would surround them and, you know, antagonize them and taunt them. And then ultimately, it led to officers being hit with buckets of water. Mm-hmm. And it seems innocuous, but, you know, these officers were, in some cases, in the middle of arresting someone, right? Mm-hmm. And one officer got hit in the head with a bucket. It actually progressed in some cases. I think someone was hit with concrete. I believe that actually happened, where it was like a mixture of concrete and water. It seems to have died down a bit, but there was definitely a heightened level of animosity in those situations.
How do the officers? How do you wrap your head around that, and how do you determine what the appropriate response is? It's an assault.
It is.
It is an assault.
It is. Yeah. It's a obstruction of governmental administration. You know, these officers are trying to do their job, acting to respond to a radio run or doing, you know, police work, and they're prevented from doing so now because they're completely doused in water. You can't do your duties when you're completely soaking wet. You have to go back to the precinct and change or whatever. And so, you know, that takes that unit out of rotation, right? And now something else could happen, and that response is, you know, may be delayed because now this unit's not available. You know, things get busy, and you know, there's a finite number of hands to answer all the calls. So I personally think it's a terrible situation, and people don't realize what could happen by doing something like that.
What's the worst thing a citizen has ever said or done to you while you're on duty?
There was a protest outside of our command. I forget exactly what they were protesting. And as I'm standing there, I was told to stand by, you know, the corner and make sure no one entered the command from the protest. They wanted to make sure that people were able to enter the command and file, you know, complaints and reports as needed without having a protest go on inside the actual premise. I'm standing there, and a guy walks up to me. He looks me square in the eye, and he says, "I'm a big fan of police suicide." And he just walks away. And he was a member of the protest. And, you know, it wasn't the words that were spoken, but the look in his eye that, you know, I was, you know, the worst thing that could possibly happen to a human being. You know, that's what I felt like as he's looking at me and saying these things, you know.
That you don't deserve to live.
Right. Yeah. That, you know, at because of what I do, right? Because obviously he doesn't know me from anyone, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know this guy. He doesn't know me. He doesn't know my story. I don't know his story.
Right.
But the fact that I'm wearing that uniform, standing there, making sure that people are able to come file their reports and, you know, get police assistance, that me being there is the worst possible thing that a human being could do. And he had to express that to me. And things like that take a toll over time, right? Sort of like chipping away. And, you know, police have thick skins, and we do. But I think anybody can only take so much before they're like, you know what? What am I really doing here? You know?
And on the flip side of that, you do believe that police officers who commit bad acts should be punished for that.
Absolutely. You know, internally, within, from what I've seen within the department, you know, there's a lot of talented people that are out there making sure that the bad cops get weeded out,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's something that's been in place for a long time, and it's only more and more attention is being paid to those things. And, you know, from what I've seen and from what the statistics that I've seen generated, you know, by our training, you know, we're overall one of the least corrupt departments in the country overall. Now, obviously, you know, any type of corruption is bad,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it only makes policing more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can't factor out all of human nature, right?
Right.
Like we talked about earlier, you know, there are some people that shouldn't be on the job, right?
Should have never been on the job.
Right,
of course. But you don't find out till they're on the job, and then you find out what they're doing wrong.
Right, exactly. So, you know, but there are many checks and balances in place to make sure that those people are filtered out, and as it should be.
You're glad you chose your profession?
I am. I really am. It's extremely rewarding, even with everything that comes with it, you know, with the added scrutiny and you know, sometimes it can be thankless in some ways, but it's extraordinarily rewarding. You know, it really is the best job in the world. An old timer told me that once when I was at the New Year's Eve detail. When you're a rookie and you come out, you know, typically you either work New Year's Eve or you work the
Times Square.
Yeah, the 4th or the 4th of July fireworks show. Mm-hmm. Like those are mm-hmm. usually the two
big ones.
Right. And so when I came out as a rookie, my first assignment was New Year's Eve. And, you know, I'm there with an old timer. He must have had, you know, 15, 16 years on.
Mm.
He's like, "Kid, this is the best job in the world." And he was absolutely right. It really is.
Well, thank you for being on PD Stories. It's been a pleasure. And you stay safe out there and continue doing what you do.
Thank you, Tom.
Officer Miguel Van Brackel, NYPD 67th Precinct. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, you're not alone. Call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255 for free, confidential support.
Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk, with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.